Hey, this is LOA Today, the Law of Attraction show. Welcome to LOA Today. Walt Thiessen and Joel Elston here. It's Thursday, November 17th, 2016. And the anniversary of my dad's birthday, Joel. He passed about 8 years ago. I miss him every day, of course. But there was also an interesting story that went with my dad's last years of his life. Sadly, he suffered from Parkinson's and ended up dying as a result of complications due to that. But the good part was that I used that situation as a way to try to learn how the law of attraction applies to disease and to health. And at the time, I didn't know enough. I couldn't really help in the way I wanted to, but I've since learned and realized that, and I feel a little bit wishful about this. I wish I'd been able to help him at the time, but I'm glad I've learned it now. Particularly with Parkinson's, it's a case of trying to get the dopamine going by being happy. And if I had realized that was the case, I would have tried to get my dad to laugh more often.
Well, and you know, you, one of the things that you often talk about is one of the tools you use in the law of attraction overall is humor, and laughter is one of your main conduits to finding sort of harmony with the law of attraction in a very positive way.
Right.
And there are tons of anecdotal stories that I have just witnessed over the years of people having severe disease and when they're nothing changed but their attitude and finding minimally some having a better quality of life once they change their attitude all the way to complete healing from quote unquote incurable diseases. So it what you're saying is supported by a lot of recent research in quantum thinking and epigenetics, is especially of what your mind's believing is what the body and your DNA will adapt to. And that's sort of the science behind the law of attraction when you look at how all that combines. And I have a very dear friend in Florida, and I think we've talked about him on the show before. He was diagnosed with had an initial diagnosis from his family care doctor that he had liver cancer and he needed to go see an oncologist. And he called me that evening. This is a very healthy man. He has always competed in triathlons and Spartan races and is in the gym every day. And so that was very shocking to hear that this 45-year-old, very healthy man was diagnosed with liver cancer. Mm. And so he had an appointment 3 weeks later with the oncologist. And I just happened to be going the following week down to my home in Florida. And I was planning on seeing him. So we set that up. And I was shocked when I walked in and saw him. He had lost, since the date of his diagnosis, he had lost like 9 or 10 pounds. He looked gray. Mm. He was feeble and actually shaking. And I'm like, oh my God, this is the most aggressive form of cancer that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And so he started talking to me about, he said he's researched it and it's really not curable. And I said, well, you haven't even been to the oncologist yet. And he goes, yeah, but you know, liver cancer, that's all he could say.
Mm.
So I said, we need to go to the gym. And he goes, no, I'm afraid I'll injure myself in the gym now. I go, but you've been in the gym every day of your life for the last 20 years, so I doubt you. But his attitude changed, Walter.
Yeah.
That's what made a difference. And so when to make a long story as short as possible, a few weeks later he goes to the oncologist, and the oncologist basically after – he was there for hours, and he kept thinking, oh, this is horrible.
Mm.
And he came in, and they kept doing it. They did CAT scans. They did all the different scans you can do. They took tons of blood. And he said, I don't know how this happened, but your readings were anomalous. You have no cancer in your liver or anywhere that I can find in your body. There's no reason for that initial test to have flared up. There's nothing wrong with you.
Wow.
And that shocked him, and it's really helped change a lot of his perspective as time went on. But he instantly, of course, I got him on the, he called me immediately, and I had some very choice words and reminded him of, you know, I can't say on the air what I thought about him, and in a very joking way, and said, you need to get your butt in the gym and start eating. Within 3 days, he gained most of his weight back. He was right. His color came back, and he instantly was the healthy person he was before the diagnosis. The diagnosis almost killed him.
Isn't that interesting, though? Because there's a lot that has been written and spoken about the placebo effect.
Yes.
And it's usually written and spoken in relation to cures that have occurred with sugar pills or the equivalent, where there was no actual medication involved, but people got better. Notice, though, that the example you brought up and the example I brought up are situations where people actually can reverse the placebo effect. They can believe that they're sick when they're not sick and make themselves sick in the process. And
absolutely.
It just goes to show it can work either way. And does it reinforce just how much in control we all are of our own situations just through what it is we believe is going on.
And oftentimes when we speak of subjects like this or seemingly in this area, a lot of we get, you know, at least I personally get pushback from people of, well, you're I have a disease and you're not respecting that or you're overlooking that I have a disease. And it isn't that I'm not acknowledging that there's some challenges there. I'm not. We're not ignoring that. What I am ignoring is the idea that you have to buy into the disease or the concept, like you're saying with Parkinson's. It is a brutal disease. There's no argument. But in that context of understanding what it does, so using the brain against itself in a positive way, forcing the body to produce dopamine, forcing the body to do this stuff. I'm not saying it cures it, but it certainly minimally makes the quality of life so much better.
It definitely does. And let's be honest, it's also going to give yourself a better chance of a cure. Because even in situations where, you know, the doctor is giving you the most dire prognosis that you could possibly have for whatever it is that's afflicting you, even in those situations, there are people who survive. There are mortality rates and there are survival rates. And no one really knows why some of them survive and why some of them don't. It's just that's what they track, and they, you know, to maintain their statistical accuracy, they have to report it that way. But not even medical science knows why some people get affected and other people don't in a wide range of areas. I mean, there are certain areas that they've learned, okay, we found new clues about why it is that some people respond well and others don't, but most of the time they don't know.
Right, and that's such an important study, an area of study, and that's where I mentioned the word epigenetics earlier.
Yeah, you've been really into that lately.
Yeah, it really is. It's sort of what I love. For a long time, I believed in the law of attraction, and a lot of times I thought it was a mystical. In the book The Secret, it's almost sold as a mystical concept, but
I think we can drop the word almost. It is.
Yes, exactly. And while I have no problem with that, I want more tangible, and that's why there's so much research in this area. There's a book called "You Are the Placebo" by Dr. Joe DiPenza, and he talks about this exact thing. He talks about how he healed a back injury, a severe back injury, by solely using his mind. It's documented. His cure's documented. There was never any surgery. He healed himself with his mind. Stuff that wasn't even possible or thought possible. And that's the place where I get excited, but also have to understand that the acceptance of the community in general, you know, it is sort of scary. I mean, because they don't like to be told this. Doctors don't like this concept. A lot of them dismiss it. A lot of them sort of like, well, we'll tolerate your thought, but, you know, still do this. And by no means are we ever suggesting we don't follow a doctor's advice. What we are suggesting is a combination of the two methods are always the most effective. And, you know, by forcing ourselves to listen to your doctor, at the same time believing what your doctor is going to do is going to cure you, and not listen to any diagnosis of, well, you have 6 months or you have 1 year or you have whatever. It doesn't help the healing process. In fact, it hinders it greatly.
Oh, it does. Absolutely. And in fact, we had originally talked about doing a topic on this show about persistence, but I'm realizing now we need to change that. Today's topic is about resistance, because that's what we're talking about. Right now you're talking about societal resistance, but there's also resistance within ourselves. I mean,
absolutely.
Every one of us has experienced it. Many of us who are perhaps on the early stages of the path may not realize that they have been resisting. I know it took me a long time to understand how I could possibly be resisting. I remember the first time that, again, it was an Abraham Hicks. Abraham Hicks's commentary to one person was about resisting and stop resisting and so forth. And if you're not feeling well, then you're resisting. If you're not feeling positive, you're resisting. And so I kind of examined myself. I said, well, I know I'm not behaving positively. I'm not behaving horribly negatively, but I'm not behaving positively. But I don't know where I'm resisting. I mean, it's not like I can, you know, open up the chassis and look inside and find the resistance monitor. You know, it's not there. So that was probably the hardest part early on, is trying to understand that. And even now, I still kind of, well, I almost said struggle. I am flummoxed by it. I get confused by it, because it seems to me at times that I am doing pretty well positively, and then things aren't quite working right, and I realize, well, I must be resisting. How am I resisting? And right. It's like I'm pulling away layers over time. Oh, there's another layer of resistance. I didn't even know it was there.
Well, and Walt, the that's such a great point, because I personally have witnessed hundreds of people, and starting with myself, of the evolution of understanding your resistance. I have, you know, the resistance. If you and I were having a conversation, and if I were to say, "Have you tried this?" and you're, "Oh no, I tried that
yeah.
or I thought about that," well, you don't realize that's a resistance. That's a, you know, what you almost fear doing is your resistance. If the, you know, like one gentleman that I was working with, he's a salesperson, and he, of all things, you being a salesperson, he has this severe fear of rejection. So that combination doesn't make for a lot of money.
No, it doesn't. And I've experienced that personally. I actually have a phobia, if you will, of my own along that line. So I am totally sympathetic to him.
Sure. So the idea that he had to either, it to make it really simple, we sat down and said, here's your resistance. Here, you know, you obviously have a fear of rejection. And it's coming across in your sales presentation. You don't ask for closes, and you let a lot of stuff slip, and or you can leave the field or adjust it. One of those two things. That's all you get to do. You can either fix it or leave the field, because you're not going to be effective by. And his resistance was that concept. Well, I don't want to leave my job, but I don't want to give up that resistance or that fear, or I don't have a way to give up that fear. And it wasn't until he, you know, through a lot of work and helping him understand, you know, processing that every rejection is eventually going to lead to a sale. So if you view rejection as just part of the process of selling, and you sort of reframe that, he became very successful when he was able to do it. But it took a while to see where that resistance was, at least for him to understand the resistance.
Well, you know, it's interesting. What you're describing is certainly not new. I've heard this kind of thing before, and indeed, it's been the most common kind of answer I've gotten, even from non-LOA practitioners, people who really have no idea of how the law of attraction works. But what I found in my own life is that approach doesn't really do it for me. And I can identify a couple of the reasons why it doesn't do it for me. One reason is I am somebody who really has to believe in what he's selling before he can sell it.
Sure.
And if I were to just take a job selling somebody else's thing, that alone would probably trip me up, because right. most of the time I don't believe in other people's products.
Right.
I am too
right.
skeptical about what's out there. So as a result, I basically, just by having that position, we can call that a resistant position. In some ways it is a resistant position. But by having that position, it basically precludes me from even doing most sales jobs.
Right. Well, but what you're identifying is a different area of resistance. Your area of resistance is selling something you don't believe in.
Right.
So the idea of finding that product or creating that product would allow you, it's not necessarily a fear of rejection as much as a fear of selling something you don't believe in. If you really believe in it, you know, that makes a big difference. I have an acquaintance from a long time ago. He was trying car sales, and he worked for a Chevrolet dealership down in Tampa. And he was not very successful at all.
I give him credit for trying. That's a tough one.
It really is. So he was about to get out of the car business when somebody at the local Porsche dealership said, why don't you try a job here? And he laughed. He said, if I can't sell Chevrolets, I can't sell Porsches.
Doesn't that sound similar to the people who say, well, I can practice small LOA, but I can't practice big LOA?
Right, exactly. And so what the guy says, he says, well, you know, what do you think about Porsches? And he goes, well, my gosh, they're probably the finest made vehicle in the world. And he goes, so you believe in Porsches? And he said, what do you really think about Chevrolets? And he said, and this is several years ago. Mm-hmm. He said, they're really poorly made cars. He said, I'm sort of embarrassed that we're doing this. And he said, well, I think you will be able to sell Porsches because you truly are selling the finest made automobile in some people's perspective in the world. There isn't even $500,000 cars don't have that name recognition, or at least that quality thought of Porsche. And so making this sort of in a perspective of the law of attraction, he bought into that theory and became wildly successful selling Porsches because he really believed he was selling the best car on the planet.
It makes a huge difference. There's no doubt about it. Yeah.
And people pick up on that whether you believe it or not. I know most people I know at some point have fallen, maybe that's not the term, have bought into the concept of multi-level marketing and tried it.
And I think fallen is probably a good one.
yeah. And so I've done it a few times, and when I would go in with skepticism with the product, I learned that I'm not opposed to the multi-level marketing theory. I have yet to find a product I really believe in. If I did, I could sell it in any format. Mm-hmm. But most of these products they're selling are like nutritional supplements. You know, most of them are maybe reasonable supplements, but they're usually horribly overpriced for what you're getting.
Yep.
And oftentimes they're not remotely what they're advertising. So you don't believe, so you can't sell. And once I'm challenged, if I really don't believe and I'm challenged on something, then it doesn't work for me. Whereas I'm talking to people about the law of attraction, even the most skeptical people I've talked to, a couple of doctors, psychiatrists, and they will, you know, they can be very intimidating at times, but I believe so much in the law of attraction and the stuff. I end up changing their minds. I end up changing their perspective because I really believe it.
Mm.
And I find that to be because I'm really into that. Whatever you believe is what you can sell. And when we take it, and that includes what we were talking about, the resistance of feeling bad. When you really believe you're going to get well, the body has no option but to make that happen. And that, I know there's people that it grinds them to hear that, because you're saying, my brother or uncle or my dad who died of this, or my sister who died of this. But it isn't that it's about they didn't believe, they really wanted to believe. The medical profession, in my opinion, totally contributes to the death by giving these dates, or by saying you have a 7 in 10 chance of dying. Well, what is the point of even saying that? What, you know, or it's incurable. What does that mean?
I can say there's at least some justification to it. People want to know what their chances are. But my objection to it is that they don't frame it right. They should be framing it in terms of what your chances are of doing successfully, not in terms of what your chances are of failing at.
Well, and this, again, comes across as to a lot of people sort of offensive at times. I have never witnessed anyone who was very serious about recovering from addiction who wasn't able to recover from addiction. When you're really, really ready, you can really, really do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never, on the other side of the coin, I have never witnessed anyone who wasn't 100% willing to stop their addiction and change their behavior and do whatever was necessary. I never met anyone who could stop.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think probably the same rule of thumb does apply to dread diagnoses and prognoses and so forth. On the other hand, I guess the other way to look at it is when you're given a prognosis with a 70% chance of successful recovery rate, what you're basically also being told is this is what the average person who has no idea how the law of attraction works does. If you know how the law of attraction works, you look how far along you are along the path before you even start.
Right. And that's where it goes. So it's a combination. I'm all about – you know, modern medicine is amazing. We have some incredible tools, but when you couple the tools with the power of the mind and the ability of the mind to control your genetics and control and change and adapt, and that, you know, there are certain populations that are resistant to certain types of disease. Like some cultures have very little cancer. Most people contribute that to diet and lifestyle. Well, there have been people who have severe cancer that leave the United States to go on missionary work. They're in remission, or they're early stage cancer, but they go on missionary work to these areas where people are living with no cancer. Well, they come back and they have no cancer. Well, what was that about? Where did that come from? Well, they lived in an environment where, or on the other hand, there's doctors who have dealt with some very rare, exceptionally rare cancers, and they're doing research on exceptionally rare cancers. One out of a million, one out of 5 million people get these cancers, and they're researching them, and these doctors develop those cancers.
Yeah, that I think is the much more telling statistic.
Yes.
Because that one, the first one you can kind of rationalize away by saying, well, that's the environment, right? That's right. The environment that they lived in, so you went to that environment, and of course you got healthy.
Right.
But the second one, that you can't really apply the same rule there, because in that case, they really shouldn't have gotten it. You know, just right. As a matter of sheer odds, they should not have gotten it. And yet, to so consistently get it, now you got a red flag going off. And the red flag really can't be attributed to too many factors. I suppose one factor you could conceivably attribute it to is that when they're studying a disease situation, they're exposed to the disease. So there's an infection possibility that goes on.
Absolutely. There. Absolutely. And within all the context of all this stuff is understanding that you are the placebo, you are the process, and that piece in combination with your environment and medical help, but it applies to all areas of our life. Is we're not just stuck on the medical stuff. It applies to finances, it applies to relationships. But the term resistance is, you know, everybody thinks they I have no resistance, but yet when you say, will you do this?
It's funny that you say that, because especially after I started studying this law of attraction stuff and listening to the gurus and trying to understand how the whole thing worked, when I finally got this idea of resistance and that it was out there, my first reaction looking at myself was, well, I don't really understand where I've got this resistance. I can't see where I'm doing the resisting. But boy, can I see the effects of it. I am definitely resisting. I just don't know where I'm doing it. So to hear about somebody who says, well, I'm not resisting, I say to myself, wow, are you really paying attention to what your own symptoms are?
Right. Well, and that's what we all do. And that's where the lever of the law of attraction, that's what I like to call it, the lever, is the resistance component is having the courage or the willingness or whatever term you want to use to move the law of attraction in your favor. It's stopping resistance, but first identifying resistance, because we all think I'm not resisting, but yet when you, the thought of doing certain things, oh no, I've tried that, or I've done this, or that doesn't work. I already know that doesn't work. And that right off the bat, you've already put yourself in a position where, okay, I can't win with that. I know people that have gone into jobs that nobody makes money at, and they're determined to make money, and they end up making a lot of money at jobs that most people aren't making money at. A lot has to do with their perspective.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I can tell you a little story that happened just a few days back. Took my car in for a 25,000-mile service, and while I'm waiting for it, sitting in the waiting room, there's a TV blaring, and I'm believe it or not, Joel, I'm actually listening to one of our podcasts.
Oh, wow.
On my iPhone. And I'm having trouble hearing it over the TV. So I look around and I see like three chairs way off in the corner, far beyond where the TV room is, as far away as you can get. So I say, okay, I'll go over there. Go and sit down. There's one woman sitting in one of the chairs. I did sit down in one of the other two. And I just sit there and start listening for a while. And she makes some sort of comment within a few moments of me being there. I don't even know what the comment was because I had my headphones on, but I took the headphones off, and I knew she was talking about how I come over from the other area. I said, yeah, that TV was just too noisy over there, and she says, oh, I know exactly what you mean. I mean, the only reason that it's even worth watching TV is to find out what the news is. Well, that was a red flag right there.
Oh, wow, yeah.
And I'm not really sure how to handle a situation like that, because I didn't know her. It's not like I had a personal relationship with this woman, right? It's not like I had any idea of what she was like, or if she had invited me to talk about LOA or anything like that. And I'm always reluctant to talk to people who aren't voluntarily, you know, involved in the decision of, yeah, I want to hear about this. But I did make a comment that, well, I don't even want to listen to the news. And I just kind of left it at that. And she's the one who inquired about it. So, you know, I volunteered my position. I didn't use the phrase law of attraction, but I described the experience of, you know, how when you're not listening to the news, not watching the news, life is better, good things happen, and so forth. And she made a very telling comment in reply. Her reply was, well, that's not been my experience. And I thought about that one later. I stopped the conversation there because she wasn't really inviting me to continue, and I refused to, you know, push farther than somebody's really inviting me to do. But I thought about that comment, and I realized how true it is. In her experience, that's not the case. Well, what would her experience be? She's listening to the news all the time. Her experience must be continued negativity. So, of course, her experience is not that when you stop listening to the news and stop watching the news that things get better, because in her experience, all she's ever done is watch the news and had things get worse. It's not the same experience at all. It's the exact opposite.
Right. And that's how we – those are the areas of resistance that it goes so far against the norm of what society thinks that you feel like you're not really participating in society – when everybody else is doing one thing and that doesn't the news will not you watching the news will have no effect on the world's outcome. It has no effect on what's happening. The concept that I must remain informed is really the concept that I must remain programmed. I must, you know, and that's a hard place to break away from because it's so anti what everybody else is doing. You know, for several months, I didn't watch the news at all, and I did take a brief break during the presidential election just because I could not help but watch that train wreck. And I watched it from such a different perspective that it really – and I quit watching it after the election, but it, for that brief time, it – actually was sort of funny. I mean, it didn't affect me in a negative way.
It's not just sort of funny. Let's be perfectly honest. I mean, we had clowns running for office.
Exactly. And you know, and I love the fact that half of everybody is upset about which clown won because they both were clowns. One of them was going to be a clown. So it's a very interesting dynamic that I was able to do. But I, as we move forward, when we understand what areas can I live in that aren't resistant, where's my strength at? That, you know, when I work with people with addiction, most 12-step programs, almost all 12-step programs have a component where they focus a lot on powerlessness. And I think that is so anti-law of attraction that it's part of the reasons why they're so unsuccessful. Now, people dealing with addiction really get their back bowed up. I'm the first to say when we are in the middle of our addiction, we clearly are powerless over our behavior. That's science, and that's not a debate. Where we do have power is when we're not actively addicted. What areas, where can I find my power and how can I live there? And that's the strength of learning I am powerful. Most areas of my life I have great power over, and I need to implement that. And that those are limited to the things that I personally can control. But, however, those are the things that matter.
They are the things that matter, yeah.
Yes. And so, you know, I'll always ask people when they come in, what are the things in your life that are in your direct control that we can work on? And they're often dumbfounded by that. And another statement I'll make, especially people when come in who are having relationship issues, I'll often say, without using another person's name or situation, tell me about your life. And they just look at me like, well, I can't do that because everything is about my boyfriend or my girlfriend being bad. Or being wrong and it's affecting my life and so that helps break through that initial. They're out of your control, so you know we have to start placing our energy and firing our all of our power at the areas that's in our control, and that's the law of attraction at work. That's the law of action at work, which is a part of the law of attraction.
It's also the law of, I guess, changing perspective, because that's what we talk about anyway most of the time, changing our focus, changing our perspective.
Sure.
That's really what this is all about. It's about changing what it is we're going to focus on and more importantly, recognizing all of the different ways that we allow ourselves to get drawn back on the dark side, because we all do it. I mean, I've been noticing it particularly of late. You mentioned the political election, and I actually did a pretty good job of staying out of it, but it does seep through at times. And I did allow myself to look at the election from afar just by watching what was going on in the polls, going directly to certain websites that I went to, because I was a political science major, Joel. That was my training in college. So
absolutely,
it's not something that I easily have let go of. I am a lot better than I used to be, but I still haven't let go of it entirely. And believe it or not, that's one of my goals. One of my goals is to stop paying any attention at all to politics, because I know just how toxic it is. It's not like there's anything positive that comes out of politics. It's all negative. So there's really no good reason to keep focusing on it from an LOA perspective. But nevertheless, there's still that side of me that just keeps getting drawn back. And that's the dynamic I'm talking about. The fact that despite my best efforts to focus on what I really truly want to focus on, it's like my subconscious mind just keeps drawing me back. And, of course, the reason it keeps drawing me back is I trained it to over the course of, a 30-year period. So it's doing a very good job of what I told it to do. But now I'm trying to convince it to do something different. And that's where it gets a little tricky, a little bit difficult.
Yes. And the concept that you're the one that sort of framed this for me a long time ago. And it made me see things in a little different perspective personally. The younger you are, the less years of resistance you have built up. So you're more open to the message. And I have actually firsthand witnessed that with many of the kids I work with, foster care kids or younger people that have struggled. And I have a young man that I'm dealing with right now. He's 20 years old, and he really good guy, but he is so stuck on all the stuff. His resistance has been so strong, so breaking him through the resistance of where he's been has been a real challenge. But yet, the fact that he is so able to let it go much quicker than the average person, he's only had 20 years versus 50 years of it, or 40 years of it, or 30 years of it. And it does make a big difference. I know with my younger class, even when I get 12 or 13-year-old foster care kids, they, remember Bob, we talked about a young man who was in foster care. He's made incredible strides. He's about to be adopted. That he was once deemed unadoptable. He was on multiple medications. He's on no medications. He's on honor roll. This is an entirely different kid that all he did, which he describes as, it's just really not that big of a deal. You just got to look at things differently. Mm-hmm. And where adults are dumbfounded by it, kids sometimes are like, yeah, okay, that's easy. That makes sense. And when you buy into your perspective is the entire reason your reality exists. And when your perspective is negative, your reality is negative. When your perspective is positive, when you look at all the great stuff you have, all the great stuff, you're more into that. That process works so much better. And it's the sort of the thought of lack. What's your perception of lack? And what am I lacking? Am I lacking money? If you are, you are lacking money. You certainly are lacking money. Mm-hmm. You're lacking relationships. Yes, you are. You're lacking health. Yes, you are. And that's where that resistance thing coming in. It's hard not to look at the lack.
And yet that's what we have to do, is to turn our attention away from it. There's an analogy that actually comes from the world of computers that I find to be useful for something like this. And I try to remind myself that this is the way changing our thought processes, even when we have a persistent negative pattern of thought, we can still retrain it away, and it's basically done the same way that it's done on a computer. Most people are at least vaguely aware that under certain circumstances, an expert computer technician can go into, say, a hard drive and extract information that got erased and get it back for you. They aren't quite sure exactly how that works, but most people, I think, are somewhat fairly aware that that can happen. Well, in a nutshell, the way it happens is the stuff that got erased really just got removed from a directory about, how to find the thing. The stuff's actually there. It's just that the directory that the computer uses to find stuff the directory's been erased. The data hasn't been erased, just the directory.
Right.
Well, the same thing happens within the human brain. If all you're trying to do is to erase what's in the directory, the data's still going to be there. So what a computer technician does, or more accurately, what a computer security expert does in order to erase bad data, is to write over it. They don't just remove it from the directory, they write over it with new data. And wow. in the process of writing it over with new data, if you do that often enough, it becomes impossible for even a, what do you call it? What's the word for when somebody does an autopsy? They do what kind of...
Forensic,
yes.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm glad you pulled that out of the air because I couldn't think of it. Yeah, even somebody who is a security forensic expert who's capable of extracting information out of a machine where nobody else could get it, if you write over the data over and over again to make a strong enough storage of data, there's no way they're going to get it. It's just not possible to do. And the same thing applies to the human mind and the brain. If you write over the data that's bad data with new good data, and you do it often enough, the brain may try to go get the old data, but it won't be available.
Right, and that is the key. It's such a when you create these new pockets of positivity or these new positive reinforcers or your belief that you live in abundance, and when that becomes your real belief system, then that's where it goes. Like you're saying, if you write over those old places enough, or this goes back to we've talked about changing traumas before. Traumatic events in my life have now been turned into not necessarily positive events, but they have been turned into life learning events, and I no longer view them as traumas because they were instrumental in getting me where I'm at. My view of them has changed. So the concept that my brain was damaged by a trauma, it also was healed in my mind. That area of damage was healed when I no longer held that trauma. I've erased the trauma by writing over it with positive thoughts about what happened, or at least necessary. That was a necessary part of my path, is sort of the dialogue that I used to write over that.
Exactly. That's what the whole point of reframing or pivoting is all about. It's about rewriting the data.
Right.
It's about changing the message that's stored in that huge library up in our heads called the brain.
Right, and that's sort of when you're able to go back and change traumas or change belief systems. You change it. It creates a backwards and forward cascading effect of attraction. Your life changes. I know people that have switched their way of thinking from "I've had the worst life on the planet" to "Wow, I have an incredible life, and I always have," and all they did was change how they viewed things, and that became their narrative, and it does change you as a person, and then that's where the concept that once the mind starts to do it, then the body does change. In The Secret, she talks about, Rhonda talks a lot about how she got to her perfect body weight by doing nothing but changing her thought about that, and I've seen that happen too when people that have done very little exercise or diet adjustment that really just started changing their perspective of their body weight, which eventually led them to feeling better about their body, which eventually led them to eating better and exercising more. But that wasn't the point. It started with a change of mindset. If every day you're dieting and thinking "I'm fat, I'm fat, I'm fat," then that is not a positive direction going forward. If you look at "I'm healthy," I'm not as near as concerned of quote unquote being fat as the fact that I want to start being healthy and focus on abundance of health, then everything else will fall into line and your body weight will adapt to a healthy weight.
And the good news, of course, is that as we do pivot, as we do change our perspective and consistently keep changing it to that new thing, even though the old stuff just keeps coming back, every time it comes back, and this is the biggest challenge of all, noting when it comes back, and as soon as it comes back, remembering, okay, what was the pivot I was pivoting to? What's the positive I was trying to move to? Oh, yeah, that's what it was. And then doing an exercise of writing that experience in its place. You do that often enough, when the negative stuff just kind of comes to you, that's what erases it. That's what ultimately changes it.
Well, and I as we always do inside of most human beings, the term awfulizing is
awfulizing. I hadn't heard that one.
Yes, it's a taught behavior, and it's where we take a situation and we automatically take it to the worst possible scenario. Mm. Many people use it as a coping mechanism. Okay, worst case scenario is my girlfriend will leave me and I will be single. That's a worst case scenario. Or this will happen, and that. So we take it to a level of discussion in our brain of what is the worst case scenario. Well, you literally are bringing about a worst case scenario. Awfulizing is the extreme wrong side of the law of attraction. It's where you're visualizing all of the awful things that could happen or could pivot from this situation. Here's how it will go to a bad place if this happens, versus using the perspective, a different perspective. I need to come up with a better term or opposite term of awfulizing and use that. But the idea that we're going to take it forward to, I'm not going to take every situation and awfulize it. I'm going to take every situation and maximize it and look at, wow, this is my life. This is where it's going to go. I have a new opportunity now. If I lost my job, there are new opportunities. Nobody has ever created, in my mind, great companies have always been created when people have lost their jobs and they needed to go do something else. And they went out and they fulfilled a need. I know of a young man many, many years ago that when McDonald's was having a hard time figuring out what to do with all their oil, all their nasty, nasty oil that they fry things in, getting rid of it was a problem. So
toxic waste.
It was toxic waste. And so he was actually working at a McDonald's as a maintenance man, and he said, well, I'll get rid of it for you, and you know, will you pay me every month to get rid of it, like $40 to get rid of it? Well, he started collecting the oil and heard about converting that oil into clean fuel. And he started recycling at various McDonald's and ended up having a contract. I don't know if it's nationwide. I'm sure everybody does it now. But the McDonald's recycles all their oil now. Mm. And this guy started that concept by fulfilling a need. He was at McDonald's. He saw they needed help. They didn't know what to do with it. He provided an answer to that need. His beginning was, to be honest with you, his beginning was just to take the oil and let's just go dump it somewhere and I'll make the money. But he realized that he had a commodity that the $40 he was getting to get rid of it for those people really was minimal. It was a tip of the iceberg of what the value of that oil was.
And that actually shows where his personal growth took place.
Yes. And that all of us have that. All of us have within us that ability. I am completely convinced everything that has happened in my life had two avenues it could take. I could awfulize each situation, and many times I did. But the great news is when I maximized each situation, it took me to the other side. It took me to another level that, you know, this wouldn't have happened, if I wouldn't have eaten out of a trash can, this chain of events wouldn't have happened, which led me to this chain of events, which led me to this chain of events, which were all positives in the end. The trash can will never be positive, but the events that were propelled from that, because I maximized the event, it turned it into a very positive direction for me. And that's what I want our audience to start working on, is watch the awfulizing. It's immediate. It takes place. The brain immediately goes into a default awfulizing thought process.
You know, immediate. I hadn't heard this awfulizing concept before. It's an interesting term. I never heard the term before today. But I can certainly see it. There's another side that I see, and maybe there's a term for it, so you'll have to tell me whether or not there is. But I would say it's probably even more common than awfulizing, and I guess I would call it almost awfulizing, because it's a tendency that many people have to hang on to some really bad situation without actually going to the end game and playing out what is the worst-case scenario when it actually happens. In other words, that always stays at the background. It stays back where you can never, ever touch it. So it creates a form of resistance, because now they have a way of feeling bad about something and constantly talking about something without actually looking at what the consequences are and without actually looking at, you know, what the end game really plays out to. And the reason this is such an effective form of resistance is that it keeps them from getting to the point where they realize, once they finally play it out in their mind, wow, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. And that's a shock.
Right. And there's almost the idea of looking at things, how bad they're going to be or almost how bad they will be, all these areas. It is a coping mechanism that has been handed down. What is the best that can happen? Where are we going to go from this? What's the great thing that can happen from this? It's very seldom when that's not where most people's mind go. When bad news or disturbing news or something comes along, well, what's the best that can come out of this? That's not what we look at. We all, you know, like you're saying, we can get stuck on the edge of or not even taking it to the extreme, or we can, well, this is the end of my life because this will happen. Mm. And it's that's not the case. It's not the end of your life. It's not the end of it. For things to fall into place, they often have to fall apart. So the idea that something falls apart doesn't mean that it's over. It means that new chapter is starting. When you live that way and you believe that way, it's an amazing journey that I'm hoping to help this family that I'm working with now, who this is a very successful gentleman that through a chain of events lost his job and he's starting his own company, and he's living in an incredible amount of fear, guilt, and shame. And that is a horrible combination.
Oh, yeah.
Guilt and shame being two different things in my mind. But he's living and inviting all this negative into it. And my goal is helping him realize there's no chance of success as long as you're believing this. It's we've got to let go of those, and it's hard to do when you're operating from a fear-based existence. It really is difficult to implement the abundance because you're worried about the lack. You're so worried about the lack of things that it just keeps perpetuating more lack.
And one of the hardest things to do when you're in that situation is starting with the basic, which is acknowledging that it's going on. Amazingly, yes. when someone confronts us over something like what this gentleman has been doing, these negative messages he's been giving himself, what often happens is the first time that someone is faced with, you know, I've been doing this, they just reject it. No, that's not it. It can't be that. That would be too simple.
Right. Well, and because things have happened negatively in the past to most people, we immediately, you know, that is sort of a marker in the brain. Traumas and severe detrimental events in our brain, they're markers. We go to them. We use them as markers of wow, I remember when my girlfriend left me and for another guy. I remember when I had that horrible illness. I remember all those things. So every time something happens, we go to DEFCON 4. And I don't. Is DEFCON 1 good or bad? I always get the DEFCON
1 is the worst, 5 is the best.
Okay, good. Okay, so we go to DEFCON 1 when it's like, wow, things are horrible. We're in bad place. And no, by going to DEFCON 1 every time something happens, you're inviting events that will take you to DEFCON 1. And that's the process. That's everything. And getting rid of that resistance is so exciting that you realize you don't have to participate in that. That's the piece that was so awakening for me, is reminding myself I can't or I don't have to keep doing that. I no longer am required to take myself to that level. And by identifying whatever I'm resisting in whatever area, that's the problem. The problem itself is not the problem. It's the resistance around the problem that I have to work on.
I don't know if you realize it, but you chose an excellent example with DEFCON, because DEFCON stands for defense condition. So DEF condition 5 is mild. DEF condition 1 is super serious. And think about it. What it basically means is I'm feeling really defensive right now.
Right. And it just... you know, when the country is in turmoil, or we feel we're being attacked, or we have this negative mood about it, everybody's on edge right now. After the election, I've noticed several of my friends are very much on edge, and you know, it's they're anticipating bad things to be happening.
Oh yeah,
and they're anticipating things, and my response is, why? What are we doing? What are you trying to bring about? I know they don't want to bring about bad things, but they have been sold on the concept that bad things are happening.
Well, it's funny because last night, as we're getting ready to go to sleep, Louise and I are talking, and she's telling me about this show she was watching on TV that I kind of came in on at the end just before we went to bed. And I could tell it was not a show I really wanted to know anything about because it was on that dreaded topic of politics and government again.
Right.
But I listened politely for a few minutes because I knew she wanted to talk about it. And then I said to her, why do you want to focus on this? And she says, well, I never studied this thing before, this particular topic that they were focusing on. And I said, okay, I can understand that. But why do you want to keep thinking about it? And she said, well, it's new to me. I guess it was about I know what it was about. It was about the corruption of Abramoff back a number of years ago. He was basically playing the casinos off against the government and all this other stuff, collecting millions of dollars in fees as a consultant and all this other, you know, corruption. And I said, okay, I can see why you at least have some interest in that, but why do you continue to want to focus on it? And so she just kept on that. I said, okay, let me say this another way. How does focusing on this stuff serve our purpose in terms of trying to get ourselves onto a positive track? And she stopped and turned on a dime and said, that's a good point. You're right. And we ended the conversation right there. And I was thinking, boy, am I glad my wife is an advocate of the law of attraction, because that made that so easy. What if that had been a different situation where my wife wasn't into that? I could just see that almost turning into an argument.
Oh, I've seen severe arguments over much less. So
yeah.
That's such a great way. When you have the ability to And especially have people around you who are receptive to using that technique. It's a great technique because, you know, how one of the things that I went into, I do consulting as well for businesses occasionally, and mostly looking at the personnel and how they're interacting and going in almost always a toxic situation. And I will go into a big group meeting and I will be amazed at everyone's perspective and how they will, you know, how they will. First, I interview them individually. Then we go into a group, and wow, it's so built into looking at all the things that are the minutia that stops companies from working is amazing.
Oh yeah,
and the idea that you can step back and you almost use that question is, what thought processes are you using right now that are moving the business forward? If you're in sales, how is this? How worrying about the man who puts out the coffee, and he didn't put out. They bought a cheaper brand of coffee for the employees. How is that affecting your sales? Why is that a problem? You know, the fact that he changed coffee brands is causing turmoil in the office is not conducive to a positive step forward.
Well, it certainly shows just how by default people live.
Right.
Because they certainly did not believe that their own thoughts and behaviors controlled their own thoughts and behaviors. They thought their thoughts and behaviors were controlled by the guy who put out the coffee.
Right. And that's where that power, the most empowering thing about the law of attraction, it places responsibility for your happiness and your life solely on your shoulders. It's also the scariest thing about the law of attraction.
It's daunting because you realize just how far you have to go before you're going to make any progress.
Right. And a lot of people don't like that. It's so much easier to be able to blame other people or other situations or some other entity that my life sucks because God is mad at me, or my life sucks because Barry put out, you know, Walmart coffee instead of Dunkin' Donuts coffee for the coffee maker. You know, or you know, our company's falling apart.
And my first reaction is, why are you drinking coffee?
Yeah. It's like, okay, well, where are we at with that? And you know, but I've also seen, I've worked with some high-end companies on Wall Street where no one makes less than $1 million a year. And I've seen the most silly squabbles take place because they've lost the perspective of what matters.
Mm.
And, you know, that one guy's like, I had to buy my own paper clips. and I pull out his pay sheet, you know, for the 6 month period, year to date. I said, you have made $974,000 in June, and you have 6 months to go. Why could you ever allow paper clips to have an issue with you? Does it matter? Why don't you go buy $100,000 worth of paper clips? It doesn't matter. You have enough money to do that.
Do you realize that with that income, he could have bought almost 10 billion paper clips?
Yeah. It's so But he said, well, it's really the point of it all. And I go, exactly.
Yeah.
You're making it about the point instead of what matters. I'm doing it for the principle of it. And it's like, no, you're doing it to create this angst that you've become accustomed to. Let go of that. Go buy the office supplies you want. If you want to get reimbursed from, send them the bill. If you don't, who cares? Take it off your taxes. It doesn't matter. It's not going to affect anything. You know, that's where we get lost in. But I see these power struggles internally with the minutia of things. It's you know, with the election, I've seen both sides do this. Okay, one side won, so let's accept our victory and move on. One side lost, let's accept our defeat and move on. But nobody's doing that.
Oh, yeah. Let's
keep hashing it up. You know, I saw this post the other day. I quickly blocked the person. They hadn't been political up to this point. You know, and they're posting all this stuff. This is post-election. Hillary did all this stuff. Well, to be honest with you, Hillary's career is done. She's no longer a factor. She spent her entire life pursuing one goal. She didn't reach it. Her consequences are pretty severe. Why don't we just move on? Why don't we just move on from that?
Yeah, that would be a nice, simple solution, actually. And yeah. I can think of another one that I saw just today. I probably shouldn't admit this, but I actually have a political blog that I built for the purpose of allowing people to expose, but to express their political viewpoints, no matter what viewpoint, any left, right, middle, up, down, doesn't make any difference. Anybody could express their viewpoints there. And this one guy who regularly writes on it, was a Trump supporter. He was kind of a reluctant Trump supporter, but he went with Trump because he's conservative, and so that's what you did. You follow Trump if you're conservative. Okay, well, Trump got elected, and he celebrates that fact, and then he wrote an entire piece about how he's glad Trump won, but here are all the reasons we should continue to be afraid.
Right, right.
And that was a deliberate message. It wasn't like he was just spouting this randomly. He was deliberately trying to tell us we had to be afraid even though his candidate won.
Right.
And the funny thing is, probably a lot of his political opponents would agree with him.
that's the point. You know, it's accepting my happiness and my well-being and my bank account is built upon me and my attitude. It is not affected by the government. My health insurance may go up or it may go down. It may do that. I may be required to. Little things like that are taking place. But at the end of the day, my personal responsibility of my happiness and my well-being lies with me. The government, the idea that the government or any other entity is in control of that is where people get stuck. So you're always, he's right. If you're believing the way he's believing, he should be scared because it doesn't work.
Yeah, well, the problem isn't that it doesn't work. The problem is that it does work, just not the way he hoped it would. Well,
exactly. It has the opposite effect. But the liberating factor is that you are no longer held hostage by these old beliefs once you give them up. It's an entirely different way of thinking and living. And things will start to manifest, come about. They come about in your life in an amazing way, and things start to be fulfilled. It's such a great journey, but it's also, in the beginning, for many people, a very scary journey.
Yeah, it's daunting because, I don't know, maybe nobody else other than me has this experience. I think probably most people do, but it's possible that they don't. All I know is that when I first got confronted in my own mind with what my task was and realized what my history was and realized all the different ways that I was working against myself, I found it to be overwhelming. I found it to be too much to handle. And as a result, it's taken a long time to handle it. What a surprise. Yeah.
Yes. Well, and as we, you know, like you said, you know, earlier, we have taken a while to get our show on podcast. You've done a great job. It's now on iTunes. People can find it. Hopefully people are subscribing and listening. And the idea that we wanted that to happen is part of that journey of where we needed to be. It's just taking us, you know, where we eventually are going to get our show on a national level. That's going to happen, but it's going to happen at the rate that we're willing to have that happen. And it's an exciting time for us as we now have we're available on iTunes. I hope that's the avenue that we get discovered, but it at the same time, it applies to our daily lives. The what you put forth every day is what you're going to get back. And remind yourself, what am I putting out there every day? Am I doing the, did I do the work to get on iTunes, or did I not do the work to get on iTunes? By the way, you did all the work to get on iTunes. Let's be clear about that.
And that's a great place to stop. We'll see you all next time here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody.